Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
To inform, inspire, and empower Alcoholics Anonymous sponsorship, locally and internationally, to be their very best, both personally and spiritually. This is the mission of RumRadio.org, an internet radio program dedicated to carrying the message of recovery to a world plagued by alcoholism and addiction. Alcoholism and addiction is the number one health issue in our world today, and RumRadio.org is actively participating in the solution. Interviews with a plethora of people sharing their experience, strength, and hope. Live Sundays at 9 p.m. Central Time and rewound again on Saturday and Monday. Tune in to 12-Stepology at its best on RumRadio.org.
Hello, welcome and hello. This is Joseph G. with Rum Radio and RumRadio.org. Excuse me. The most comprehensive 12-step sponsorship in the known and the unknown universe, which has gotten a little smaller. If some of you haven't heard yet, the scientists have discovered a parallel universe unbeknownst. It was brand new to our understanding and knowledge. I was so excited by this proposition, I went out immediately and applied for the position of center. I might not be much, but I'm all I think about. I'd like to acknowledge WNAH, it's Hoyt Carter and Tony the Horse, who afforded us the opportunity to broadcast live on their listening audience in Nashville, parts of Kentucky, and Sweet Home, Alabama. And they do this as a public service presentation. We also like to acknowledge RecoveryToday.net magazine. It's one of the finer recovery journals, and they afford us some print space from time to time. I'd gratefully like to introduce my co-host, Harold B. He's a family intervention specialist, and he does a fine work with troubled families. And I personally believe that the families are the basic unit of our society. As the family goes, so does the nation. So does the country, basically so does the world. What we have found, most of the problems we have in drugs and alcohol is because of children not being taught correct principles. Excuse me. Once a child is taught correct principles, they can teach themselves. But without that moral foundation, it's a crapshoot. They grow up as latchkey kids, empty lot weeds. They learn from the gangs and the clubs, and it's sex, drugs, and rock and roll, folks. And the drugs and the alcohol hang in for a very long time. And the sex ain't bad either. But what happens is we have this whole generation of dysfunctional folks. And so what do they do for
a
living?
To send a message now, press pound. To mark the message private, press 1. To mark the message urgent, press 4.
Anyway, so Harold, how
are
you doing
tonight? To hear your message, press 5. To re-record, press star.
Harold, you there?
It's Darlene.
Oh, Darlene. I'm sorry. I thought it was... yeah, I had called you on another number, the 310-458-0016.
Yes.
Oh, I called that number, and it rang. I thought you were on that number. Okay.
Well, I'm waiting
made it
here.
In yet. Hello?
Hi, I've been waiting.
Oh, okay.
Hello?
Yeah, it looked like you had just got on. So I thought you, Harold sometimes comes in with the the way it registers.
Okay.
It's a distinct 111111111 number.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me on your show again.
Oh, you're quite welcome.
I should say back on your show.
I got a really good response. Some fella had read your book. It was one of the codependent books and about addiction. He said it really saved his life.
Oh, my goodness. Well, that's always nice to hear.
Yeah.
That's why I'm doing this.
Yeah, that's what I thought, too. It's always good to hear that, you know, when you sometimes like what we do is, you know, we throw this out and we're hoping that it's helping, but we really don't know what the impact is until we actually hear something back.
Well, I've gotten a lot of good feedback on Amazon for my book, so I suppose people are finding them useful. Hello?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, okay.
Just listening.
Mm-hmm.
Harold's usually him. What happens sometimes, Harold gets Harold's a very intelligent man, and like a lot of intellects, common sense is kind of a reach. What I've discovered is common sense isn't as common as you might think.
Right.
It happens to me too. I understand.
We can make things too complicated sometimes.
Well, we spend a lot of time in the intellectual mind, and things just kind of get away. I was in a bar one time early on, years ago, and of course you're always intellectual when you're in your cups. And one fella goes, we were talking about the difference between intellect and common sense. And he says, take it for instance, there's a fire. And someone, the intellect wants to know how much fuel is this fire consuming? And what's the heat of it? And how close can I get to it? And how long will it burn? And, you know, what's the practical application of this fire? And common sense says, don't touch it, you'll get burnt.
Mm-hmm.
And
we'll put it out.
I made this up recently. Chancing upon a fire, most will sound an alarm. Some will run for a bucket. And a few will see the opportunity to toast marshmallows.
That's clever.
Yeah,
well, that saying, kiss. Keep it simple, stupid.
Yeah, I get that a lot. I get pretty deep with some of this stuff. I do a lot of study, and it enlivens my mind. So I go into areas that usually most folks don't delve into, whether they need to or not, but that's where I go sometimes. And I'm writing something right now, and one of my daughters said, Dad, you better let me read it first. Sometimes you just get people over people's heads too much. You know, they don't get what you're saying. And with the alcoholic and the addict, if you do that, it's in the big book. It says never talk down to an alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
And when you do that, the impression is that you're talking down to someone when they don't get what you're saying, and it makes them angry and it confuses them. So I have to be very careful. Well, if you just give me a minute, I'd like to – usually we start the show.
Oh, you haven't started yet. I didn't know if we were on the air or not.
Yeah, we're on the air. We're on the air.
Oh, okay.
We're on the air. We're just
– Yeah. Okay, go ahead.
We like to start with disclaimer. First of all, we're not AA, which is Alcoholics Anonymous. We're not NA, which is Narcotics Anonymous. And we're not CA, which is Cocaine Anonymous. We're Rum Radio and rumradio.org. We're closer to Paranoids Anonymous. The only problem is nobody will tell you where they hold the meetings. And if your recovery has, if you're into restless laurelitis, if you've fallen asleep on your recovery and you're just lopping along, consider this a wake-up call. If you're a member of Narcoleptics Anonymous. I have epilepsy. And at church today, they were talking about King David, his high priest Abathar, and Saul. And all three of them, and a lot of folks don't know this, but all three of them suffered from epilepsy.
Really? Oh.
Yeah. It's in there, but it's in the very... it's just like a little innuendo. Well, Saul is not known for epilepsy. No, David, there's a section in the Bible where the Philistine princes have him. They catch him, and he's drooling from his beard and all that. And so even the scriptures say that he was acting. Well, he wasn't acting. No, that was, he was having an epileptic seizure, you know, but they said that was mad. And then his high priest Abathar, when he died, his brother Adonijah, Solomon's brother, tried to take over the throne. And then when Solomon got in, King Solomon got in the throne, he killed Adonijah, and the high priest went along with Adonijah instead of Solomon. But instead of killing him, he says, because you had the same affliction of as my father, he banished them. So there's a thread to show that they, all three of them, had epilepsy, which was also known later on as the royal disease.
Oh, uh-huh. Yes.
That's where that kind of just come up from, genetically predisposed. But anyway, okay, so we're way off track.
You were
kind of
talking about raising children and your studies, and I have to say that when I was doing the research and preparing to writing the book that I recently wrote, Conquering Shame and Codependency, I really regretted that I hadn't done the research on shame before I had children. I learned so much, and parents can shame their children inadvertently, and shame really underlies codependency and addiction. I mean, my own feeling is that codependency underlies all addiction. So it all starts in the way parents parent their children.
Oh, I agree 100%. I, the personal experience, I have a my brother Robert and I, we grew up, and I was more of a, I don't know, what's a good word to say, pretentious child. You know, I was pretty rough. I was a hard, my grandson is just like me. I can't stand him, but he's all over the place, and, you know, but really gets into trouble all the time, and I got almost beat, physically beat every day.
Oh, my God.
And, yeah, it was tough. I did a lot of therapy, but that's how my parents were brought up, and, of course, they just mimic what they believe to be the correct procedure. But I was always, you know, that was physically beaten. My younger brother, Robert, was always ridiculed, and he was always told how dumb he was and, you know, that he would never amount to anything and, you know, all of that. And he told me, he said he would have rather been physically beaten than ridiculed and humiliated as a child. Because I could see that still hangs with him even to this day, that he still has a very low self-esteem because of that.
Yeah, sometimes, you know, when you're physically shamed or by your boundaries, any kind of boundary invasion is communicating that you don't matter, your needs don't matter, your feelings don't matter. But some children can figure out that the parent, that that's wrong, that there's something wrong with the parent. But in other cases, double messages, manipulation, control, subtle criticism and shaming, children believe that they're the problem, and it can be more insidious because even into adulthood they may not realize that they were shamed or what's the cause of their low self-esteem and insecurity or anger, because it could be more subtle.
Oh, no, absolutely. Well, I'm a lay person, but I, you know, like I tell people, I don't have any credentials and I don't have any certificates of completion, but I have spent the night at a Holiday Inn Express. And what that means is I have certain life experiences that lend itself to observation and understanding. And I can see at a certain age, by a certain age, if children are not or inundated with this kind of negativity, that it's almost impossible to overcome later on. It's so ingrained. You can see it.
Even parents saying, you have it too good, or you don't know what it was like when I was a kid, or taunting them with, saw one mother in a store is like holding a ice cream licking some ice cream and then offering it to her toddler who was reaching for it and crying for it, and she would show it to her and then pull it away.
Oh, man.
So that kind of taunting. And that's and was the mother thought she was playing a game that was playful, but as an observer, I could see that that's humiliating to the child, that her needs or her wants are being toyed with, that it doesn't matter, that she's not important. And so that's the message that's given. Even parents that are well-meaning, let's say a parent is depressed or sick, and a child starts to feel that it's her fault or his fault, or a parent is ill and doesn't have the time or energy for the child, and the child will start to feel that they're not important enough. They don't understand at a young age that parents have their own problems and that they're separate from them because they haven't individuated into separate, psychologically separate beings. And that's how we develop a separate self. That's how we don't become codependent, is by a parent honoring who we are and reflecting our needs, our wants, our feelings, loving us as an individual, not just for their own purposes, their own needs. And when parents do, for instance, what your parents did, they're projecting, they're transferring their own shame that they're not aware of onto their children. So people do that all the time. If they're arrogant, judgmental, shaming, blaming, all that is a projection of their own feelings of inadequacy onto someone else.
Now, we have mostly, we could get in pretty deep. My family is so dysfunctional, we could do several programs on that. But that's not what we're here for. I'd like to connect that up with the addiction community. Children really are the crux of the society, I believe, that once if children are taught correct principles, that's easy to say, but morality, right and wrong, good and evil, however you want to couch that, in a loving, nurturing way, they seem to grow. You know, their education and, you know, they become an integral part of society. But when that's missing, we have generations now of drug addicts, alcoholics. I think 80% of the people in prison are connected up with drugs and alcohol.
Mm-hmm. Well, the key to what you said is in a loving way, because there are a lot of people that grew up in religious homes and they're codependent or they have some sort of addiction because there's a lot of rigidity of rules and control. It could be very off. A lot of times a parent is authoritarian and rigid, and then it breeds anger in the children, and again, their own feelings and thoughts and needs might not be taken into account. So actually, control is shown to be a factor in people becoming codependent. If a parent, usually if the mother is obsessively controlling, or if one of the parents is authoritarian, it can lead to codependency in the children.
Yeah, I had that with an ex-wife that just moved into Texas. I can't believe she finally made it here, and my children are here, and it's unbelievably bad right now. I'm just unbelievable. If I told you, you would make your hair turn white, you know. And the kids have really suffered from it. I don't know if you know, I've had two daughters die from addiction. It's tragic. It's the influence that parents have on their children is just so monumental. It's just unbelievable. Some people, I've noticed in the addiction community, most folks come in, most of the people come in are from dysfunctional homes by far. Every so often we'll get one, you know, there'll be one that comes from a functional home. as far as both intents and purposes. They had resources. They had loving parents. They had religious instruction. But they just decided that or genetically predisposed to be an alcoholic or a drug addict. You run into that at all?
Well, sometimes people think that everything is functional and like cancer, they think they had a good childhood. But, for instance, their parents may be very shallow and unemotional, and so that their needs never get, their feelings, I mean, never get responded to. So it's like they're in this emotional vacuum, and they start to feel isolated and alone, even though everything looks good on the outside.
Sure.
So, I mean, I grew up in a home that probably looked pretty good. Everyone was, you know, college was encouraged. There was no obvious addiction or drugs used or alcohol, no beating, nothing like that, or incest and everything. But I had a very controlling mother, and it was like her way or the highway. So it bred a lot of anger, and also that I didn't get to be myself. In order, this is another thing. It's like, in order to get be loved by your parent, a child will decide either that I have to be powerful and strong, or I have to please my parent, or other children just withdraw. So these are the ways they cope with the situation. And even though sometimes it looks fine on the exterior, and then they come to therapy and they think, well, I had a happy childhood. And then they start to really analyze and look at it and think, well, actually I felt like misunderstood, or I didn't feel like I fit in, or I never felt like my parents got me, even though they said they loved me. So, you know, they never saw anger, for instance. Well, that's not healthy. So a child thinks that they don't know what to do with their anger. So it's not easy to be a parent. You have to be yourself. Working on yourself is the best road to being.
I see
a
Harold made it. And Harold, you there?
Yes, I'm here. Hello.
Hi, Harold.
Darlene is, if you notice, Darlene is doing another show with us. She's graciously agreed to do that. Did you have any comments or questions for her?
Well, yes, I'm really pleased to be on the program. I had car trouble earlier, if that makes any sense.
Of course it does. You have an old car.
Yes, dead battery. So, but it's fixed now, so I appreciate everyone's patience. And it's really, I've heard what you've been talking about with Darlene and kids and codependency. And I'm sure it's going to be a really great program. So, yes, kids, what I've noticed is that kids will somehow automatically blame themselves for the negative things that go on in their childhood. And even though I've spent a couple of decades encouraging kids not to do that, it's just such an automatic response. They take the blame for their parents' divorces. They take the blame for the abuses that they've been subject to. And it's just a mess. So I continue in this work. I see a lot of families and a lot of kids and a lot of parents. And it's in fact, Wednesday night was my first night teaching recovery at the state prison, Jester 1, in Rosenberg. So there were 60 men showed up, and they were very grateful to have us come in and teach. So it's a privilege to do that. And it's true that most of the time what got them there was alcohol and drugs, or that was a major factor. So why don't you continue, Joseph, Darlene?
Well, yes, I think, I don't know if I mentioned it, that even toddlers, if their parent is depressed, that they think it's their fault, that their mother is not responsive, or if they're neglected, they blame themselves. If they're not, whatever it is, they start to do that. And by not being validated and mirrored by their parents for who they are, they don't really start to develop an independent, separate psychological, cognitive self. So that's,
yes, they don't individuate.
Exactly. So that's a basic human need, and that's what breeds codependency as well as shame. And then as adults, you see that they take on responsibility for other people's actions and feelings, and that's what causes so much conflict and high reactivity in couples that are, especially, you know, where there's a codependency and addiction. So they feel guilty if someone has a problem and they don't fix it. They feel like right away they have to jump in and do something. If someone comes home from...
I responded to the three unspoken rules: don't talk, don't trust, don't feel.
Yes. So, I mean, if... let's say a wife comes home from work and her husband is in a bad mood, or vice versa. Right away, the other spouse says, well, "Are you angry at me? Did you do something wrong?" And the first spouse might get defensive and say, "Why are you always blaming me?" And then pretty enough, they're in a fight. And it's just, I'd be feeling, or I've seen them in therapy together, and one is feeling angry or sad, and right away the other one starts getting defensive or blaming, and it has nothing to do with them.
Right.
So, yeah.
I'd like to get your take on this. I had read a book several years ago, more than one book, but it's this one in particular. Pia Melody did the Facing Your Love Addiction.
Yeah.
And I felt that a very revealing work. It's a phenomenal work. I would recommend it to anybody under any circumstance. It's just good knowledge. But she coined the phrase love addict and an avoidance addict, and how that plays out. I usually use the Gone with the Wind scenario, you know, the Rhett Butler Scarlett O'Hara and Ashley, you know, that played out. You know, one was a love addict and an avoidance addict, but she was, at the same time, she was a love addict to someone else. Now, my parents were two love addicts, tremendously so. The oxygen couldn't get in, and they were such love addicts that to the avoidance of their own children.
Oh, so you experienced neglect because of that.
Yeah, well, I didn't know. Basically, we were told we were an intrusion
to
their relationship.
You feel like a burden. So that's a shame.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Message.
We were always let to know. Yeah, we were always made to feel that we were just an intrusion to their relationship.
Exactly.
And they made no bones about it.
Yeah, I talk a lot about that, and I have a whole chapter on relationships. It's called The Pursuer and the Distancers, how we refer to them. And there's a blog on my website called The Relationship Duet, or I think I call it The Dance of Intimacy also. And I talk about that, and inside every pursuer is a distancer. And inside every distancer is a pursuer. It's like the unconscious is manifest in the other person, but underneath they both have shame. They both fear intimacy is problems are a reflection of codependency. And so they are afraid of being rejected, being judged, being abandonment. Abandonment is a major fear for people with internalized shame that have addiction or codependency. So
can you say more about the distancer?
More about what?
The distancer?
The distancer, yeah. The distancer has disowned their own needs for dependency, love, emotions. They've learned to be self-sufficient. They're afraid of being smothered or losing themselves. They might be afraid of being judged. Maybe they had an invasive or controlling parent. And the pursuer, on the other hand, is afraid of being abandoned. And their autonomy needs are repressed. They need to learn from the distancer how to be separate, to do things on their own, to be take more responsibility from themselves. And the distancer needs to learn how to say, I need you. I miss you. You know, and you see these a lot, this imbalance often in codependent relationships where I call it top dog and underdog. So you have maybe an addict is underdog who feels like I can't take care of myself, I need you. And then the other partner, I see them as both codependent, but the other partner feels like I'm responsible for you and you're the cause of my problems. They feel self-sufficient and invulnerable, and they feel guilty if they're not giving and they're not helping, and they feel love when they are giving and helping. And the reverse is true for the underdog. Underdog, there's like two sides of a coin. They make a whole. The underdog feels love when they're receiving. They also feel guilty sometimes that they're needing help. But underneath, they both are in this indispensable, they feel like the other is indispensable, and they both fear abandonment. And they both have shame underneath, that they feel unworthy, and they blame the other, it's all your fault. Let's say the addict blames his spouse or her spouse for the drinking. They both feel unworthy. The other caretaker spouse says, if only you would get sober, everything would be okay. Poor me, they blame each other, and they both feel unworthy underneath. They both have to kind of separate and feel their own shame and emptiness and start to heal on the inside. And same with the pursuer and the distancer. And even if a lot of times people experience that when they're dating, but it happens, as you said, like in a marriage. So they can both be, one could be a pursuer and the other a distancer. And one complains that, you know, my wife is always involved with her family or the children and I don't get attention. Or the wife says my husband works too much and he doesn't talk to me or is on the computer. So they both have their ways to avoid intimacy. But underneath they have to deal with their own feelings of emptiness. And they can switch roles. So in one relationship you might be the pursuer, and then in the next relationship you're the distancer. These are just kind of constructs. Nobody is like 100% one or the other. They're just theoretical
yes.
constructs to be able to talk about it. So.
Interesting.
I experienced that because in one relationship I was the love addict. I was the pursuer, and then in the next relationship after that, I was the avoidance addict. And it seems like it flip flops like that from one relationship to the next. It's like you've had enough of the first one, so that wasn't going to happen again. But it just seemed like it just kept going back and forth like that.
Yeah, or your typical stereotypical codependent is like hurt because they don't not feeling loved enough, or they feel this abandonment. So then they pull back and they become I call it counterdependent. I don't call it like avoidance addict, but they become counterdependent. It's not true independence because they're highly reactive, and so they have rigid boundaries and they're afraid to get close. They boomerang, you know.
Well, which is the nice part, though, is that because you're not available, you make it more desirable.
Yeah, until you find somebody that you fall in love with, and then you go back to your own.
Then you go
pattern.
Back. Yeah, then you go back to the pursuer again, and then she's got the rigid boundaries, and now she's not available, which makes her more desirable.
There's something that I write about in my book called The Cycle of Abandonment. So if you have this early emotional, it doesn't have to be that a parent isn't there. It's this emotional abandonment I'm talking about, where like you had in your own family, or a parent is ill, or even maybe the parent seems like they're very involved, but they're telling you, don't cry, don't get angry, you shouldn't feel, you know, you shouldn't feel this way, you shouldn't feel ashamed, you know, shaming your feelings, so they're emotionally not available to the child. So there's this early abandonment growing up leading to shame and feeling of insecurity and isolation, and it develops this fear of intimacy because you don't want to repeat. You don't want to, when you get close to someone, it brings up all the feelings you had with your parents growing up. That's your first experience of an intimate relationship. It sets like a template, actually.
Right.
So you're afraid of that. You're afraid of being controlled or judged or abandoned. So what happens is you unconsciously end up in these relationships that are abandoning. So, and then you feel more abandoned. You have more shame, more fear of intimacy. And either you go to another relationship that repeats that, or you withdraw from relationships altogether and you feel like all more shame. It's like, I'm never going to meet anybody. What's wrong with me? You know, women don't like me, or men don't find me desirable. And it keeps, but you can interrupt that with recovery and start turning it around and building your self-esteem. It all starts with how you feel about yourself.
Interesting. Now, what do you think of Al-Anon as a vehicle for codependency?
Well, it saved my life. I was in there for a few decades, so I feel very highly of it. I refer a lot of people for Codependency Anonymous, Codependence Anonymous, CODA. So either program is reinforcing the same 12 steps and the same taking responsibility for yourself, looking at yourself, doing inventory, sharing helps to minimize your shame, knowing that you're not alone, getting that support, building your self-esteem, learning to share your feelings.
Yes,
yeah,
I'm
an Al-Anon.
Meetings for years.
Say that again, Harold.
I've done CODA meetings for years. CODA's great.
Yeah. So if you don't have a relative or, boyfriend, girlfriend, partner that's involved with drugs or alcohol, then CODA is the best relationship for, best program for you.
Oh, okay. I always thought of, like, CODA is like the mother of all recovery programs, you know. Everybody's codependent on something. You're either codependent on a drug or alcohol or on a person,
mm-hmm.
on
mm-hmm.
money, on gambling. There's always that circle that there's something, you know, until we change that dependency from emotions, things, and change it to God, it seems like it just keeps going around in the same circle. You see that? You see is the spiritual solution to this, or do you see it more of a
well, it depends.
Medical
phenomenon? I guess it depends how you define it. I just want to respond to something you said a minute ago that is interesting difference between Al-Anon and CODA, and
mm-hmm.
that is, and I'm not making a judgment about Al-Anon because I think it's a terrific program, but when you go to Al-Anon, you don't identify yourself like in AA. You say, you know, my name's Jane.
Yeah.
I'm an alcoholic.
Identity statement. Yeah, this is
and
identity
the same
statement.
In CODA. In Al-Anon, you don't do that. There isn't a name for it. So people are talking, if they've been there a while, hopefully they're talking about themselves, not the alcoholic. But it's a shift in taking responsibility and awareness to say, I'm the one, I'm here, I have the problem. It took me a while, probably a few years, in Al-Anon to really commit to the program, not to help my husband, not, you know, but for myself. So in the beginning, I thought, why in the world am I here? I don't have a problem. So it took a while for that to sink in, whereas in CODA, that's the foundation of it. But you asked me a question. Didn't you ask me a question?
I forgot the question now.
Sorry.
Really? Well, the difference, that was your answering, was that the difference was that the codependent, everything is dependent on something. But I can see, I've been to many Al-Anon
meetings. Oh, you asked
me
about God.
Meetings.
Yeah,
yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah,
God.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah,
the
spiritual solution. Yeah.
Well, that's, I think, the focus of the 12 steps. I think it kind of depends on, you know, how everybody defines their higher power differently. What was interesting in doing my research is that, well, first let me say I have a whole chapter on emptiness, which I think is the underbelly of addiction and codependency and shame. And there's not a whole lot written about it in the recovery literature, but I devoted a whole chapter to it, and it ended up twice as long as what I planned. And in my research, it was interesting to read what Krishnamurti wrote about it. I compare existential, psychological, and spiritual emptiness. And Krishnamurti would go further than even Carl Jung, who would say spirituality is the answer, God is the answer. And he talked, you know, with the founder of AA, they corresponded, Bill Wilson and Carl Jung, that realized there's a spiritual solution. But Krishnamurti would go even further, that we have this emptiness inside of us, and we try to fill it up with food, drugs, alcohol, you know, relationships. And he goes on to say, even God. We even try to fill it up with God. But that will always disappoint us because it's part of who we are. And the solution is not to try to fill it up, but to accept it and to actually love the emptiness. And once we cross over to that and we're able to just be with it, then the loneliness and emptiness can turn into fullness and feeling alone but content. Not feeling lonely, which is very close to shame, or feeling alienated, but that's really true spirituality, is feeling that oneness within. So,
I don't know. That's a little abstract for me. I'm a God guy. That's going like, here's something Jung wrote, and then I really liked the way he phrased this. It was in Spiritus contra spiritum, spirit against the ravages of spirit. So this is when one of the letters, I think one of the titles of the letters, corresponded with Bill W. His craving for alcohol was the equivalent on a low level of the spiritual thirst of our being for wholeness, expressed in media of language, the union with God.
Yes.
Carl Jung. So this is just saying, okay, we got this emptiness. So both of these pillars had agreed, okay, we got an empty spot. So Carl's saying, yeah, we got an empty, but you could fill it with God. And the other fellow, what was his name again?
Bill Wilson? Carl Jung?
No.
Oh, Krishnamurti.
No, the other one.
Krishnamurti.
Yeah, Murti. Yeah. Was saying that, no, the emptiness is just there, and no, you don't have to try to attempt to fill it. Just accept that there's an emptiness. So I see God as filling that hole. You know, we call it the God hole. you know, that it could be filled. And, but that hole is, you know, when we say it's filled with God, I believe that, now this is personal stuff, but being in service fills that hole. When we turn our mind to someone we can help, that fills that hole. Because now I'm away from my mind. I'm away from my problems. I'm away from me. And I'm concerned about the next guy. So I wrote this, when we're in the service of our fellow creatures, are we not in the service of our God? And when we're in that service and in that moment, are we not divorced from self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity? And in that service and in that moment, is that not when we make our conscious contact with our Creator, who lives from moment to moment, eternity to eternity, life everlasting? The magic words in AA is action and more action. And when I'm writing to NA, I put now in action. You know, they get some of the NA folks are like the AA folks. I don't get it. They have this, you know, my drug program could beat your alcohol program kind of deal. Like, where did this come from? You know, what is this, the seventh step?
Well, that's the 12th step is spirituality in all our affairs and being of service. So.
Yeah. I mean, that, yeah. And then, you know, but that really, that fills the hole. It really does. I mean, the hole is when you're all about you. You know, I said, try to always surround yourself with positive people, because negative people are much too busy surrounding themselves with themselves.
Yeah, you know, it could be a trap for some codependents because they're addicted to caretaking. And so I think it's some people have to be careful with that, and they start to feel guilty. That's what I was saying, like this top dog. If the alcoholic gets well, he starts to feel like, you know, I'm not going to be needed anymore. They only feel loved if they're needed, if they're giving, if they're helping. Otherwise, they start to feel the shame. So the real healing comes back to being able to heal themselves, not having this compulsion to help and to give and to take care of somebody else and to try to control someone they can't control. So,
and part of what I was talking with a friend, and the topic of solitude came up.
Yes.
I think solitude is very important in recovery. Some people just cannot be alone, and so they're constantly surrounding themselves with people, especially other people that they can help, and just chase away that chatter in the mind. I think, and we don't hear much about solitude, the importance of solitude, but I think it's a very important aspect of recovery.
Exactly, and that's actually the antidote to stopping this pursuer-distancer cycle that people are in, is to then be with your own self, your solitude, and that's actually kind of what Krishnamurti was talking about too, to go within and be. When you fill up from the inside, whether you call that God or whatever name, your higher power, whatever that is, then you have something to genuinely give without it being a compulsion, without trying to control somebody else, but being, you know, to be able to be with someone and still have your own boundaries. Know that you are in charge of your own happiness, because you're coming from a place of fullness rather than emptiness. So I think it's so important here what you're talking about, that the solitude is very important.
Something I want to regress for a second, and I've noticed this in the program quite often. I got 17 years now, so I've seen a lot of it come and go. People will all of a sudden get well in the program, and now they're married or they have a long-term committed relationship. But now the woman gets well, and the husband wants a divorce, and vice versa. You know, would think, gee, they would be excited to see their partner getting well, But it's, I see, not all the time, but often enough, where there's a divorce right after recovery.
Well, it changes the whole. I look at relationships systemically, that it's a system, just as I was talking about the pursuer and the distancer, the top dog and underdog. So when one person, the underdog, gets well, it throws the whole system off. You know, it's like they have to learn new dance steps. So the person who was sober now is like, you're talking about that's the person who wants the divorce?
No. Yeah, well, the opposite.
There could be either
one.
I don't know.
No, well, sometimes, but most often it's the person that was who got well. Was the other person that wanted the divorce. The dynamic has changed. It was like control. Like they didn't have the control. You know, while she was drinking, he had a lot of control. While she was drinking, he had control, and then vice versa. When he was drinking, she had a lot of control. And now they're getting sober, they're getting well, they're losing some of that. Is it a control issue? Because
well,
of
that's
the divorce?
Part of it. There's control under that, underneath, again, is shame. But also, they don't have any way to communicate except around the drug. They're not having any authentic communication or intimacy, and often the sober spouse still has a lot of resentment because feel like they've had abuse for all these years, and a lot of times now they, okay, now I'm going to tell you what it was like to the sober spouse, and he or she is feeling very fragile. They may have a lot of guilt about their past, and they don't want to hear all this criticism and blame about things they may not even remember what they did. They may have been in a blackout, so that's one thing. Or they may be spending a lot of time in meetings, and so the other spouse feels neglected. It's like, I always couldn't wait to have this time together, and the sober partner is very involved in the recovery, and that comes first. And the other partner, if they're not an Al-Anon, which could be very helpful, doesn't understand why they're feeling neglected. And the sober partner may also be afraid of the intimacy because they haven't had to build any intimacy because they've been drinking or drugging, and they may be avoiding intimacy because of that. So there's a lot of changes now. The whole communication patterns have to be healed. So I sometimes help clients do that. For a while, I think they recommend that for a while each person work on themselves, not try to work on the relationship too soon after a divorce. Because they've been so enmeshed, they've been so dependent on one another, that they have to kind of learn to each stand on their own two feet a little bit and then come together more in a healthy way.
Oh, that makes sense. Yeah, and they want, you know, as alcoholics, we want it right now. You know, we want to fix right now. Lois Wilson really speaks to that because when Bill got sober, he wasn't available because he was drunk, and then, you know, poor Lois, now he's sober and he's on his mission.
Right.
You know, bringing drunks home, and if he's not there, he's somewhere else trying to, start AA or build a program or go to the hospitals. And, you know, and this poor woman who'd been hanging out with this drunk all these years and was hoping now she's going to get a relationship, that's not happening.
Yeah,
now
she feels
now
like
we've got another deal
going. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And,
so,
of course,
yeah.
She started Al-Anon. I mean, that was the only, she realized that, well, the only thing she's going to be able to do is to join the fight in another arena.
You could see it as a way that the addict was a, if you want to call it like an avoidance addict, because his primary relationship was with the alcohol. So
right.
Then he gets sober, and he's still avoiding intimacy, but instead, it's spread out to the community. You know, his work is in the community. So he's not building an intimate relationship with his wife. And apparently they worked it out, so they had this kind of maybe unspoken agreement. They weren't going to have that much closeness in the relationship. She was going to work in Al-Anon. He was going to work in AA. And they would have like parallel kind of that relationship. Every relationship, I think, couples have to negotiate how much closeness they want and how much intimacy. You're saying your parents both wanted a lot of intimacy, so it worked for both of them. But sometimes one person wants one thing, the other wants another, and so there's all these arguments. Could be about a million different things, but often it's about how much closeness we're going to have, how much autonomy are we going to have.
Well, I see that with my parents, they were sort of like the poster children for codependency and love addiction. I mean, mm-hmm. they were so close, oxygen couldn't get in. Mm-hmm. They stopped growing. They
yeah.
stopped emotionally, spiritually, intellectually. They stopped and actually probably regressed
mm-hmm.
because the relationship was that tight, that binding. Now, from the outside, you say, oh, isn't that wonderful? Look at them. You know, they have this just this deep, abiding, romantic love that went on forever, but it was to the point of suffocation.
Yeah. So they didn't become individuals.
No, they meshed. You couldn't tell where one started and the other one ended. And I saw that more later on, but not as a kid, you know, like who knows things
so
like that.
A lot of times, like my parents had a very typical relationship for the 50s in that generation. My father was, his primary focus was on his work. And my mother's primary focus was on the children. She worked too, but I think my dad was kind of a workaholic and she felt neglected, and so she put a lot of that, her needs and energy, into her children and became over-involved in her children. So that was a balance, but there was sort of a mutual unspoken agreement that's the compromise they work out. I know some couples where they live in separate apartments or even separate cities or even separate countries, and it works for them. You know, that's the amount of closeness that they want.
Separate countries sounds a little extreme, you know. Like, but I understand it could be a financial situation or it could be a religious consideration. I've seen that many times with folks over the years where, you know, the husband would have a mistress and the wife was really involved with the children, and they didn't really even live together, but they would not
mm-hmm.
divorce because they didn't either want the stigma or because of church religious dogma considerations
mm-hmm.
or financial hardship. They stayed
mm-hmm.
married until one of them died so they could throw the party.
Yeah, I don't have judgment about it. I think every couple has to work it out, you know, for themselves. It's like what works for them.
I early on in AA, my first sponsor, Kenneth, told me, he says, looking for a mate in AA was like looking for Olympic hopefuls in a polio ward. And I've kind of seen that over the years, too. Like, there'll be these, we call it on the campus, but in the AA meetings, and, of course, we go there. These are the same men and women that you would have been at the bars, but we have a commonality now and an intimacy that few people get to experience, and there's a lot of romantic entanglements. And then eventually, not all the time, but eventually they don't work out. And when they don't, the guy will come in, the male will come in, and he'll be, you know, he broke up and he's forlorn and, you know, he's never going to meet another her and he doesn't know he's going to drink over it and all this pity pot stuff. And then a couple days later, the female walks in, the girl walks in, and she goes, oh, I feel free now. I have wind under my wings. Is this just a phenomenon in AA, or is that just a men more traditionally codependent in a relationship?
I don't know. but it sounds like you're talking about the 13th step.
No, not necessarily. Sometimes it does work out that way. Sometimes I've known one guy 13th stepped his wife, and they're still married. You know, they've been married for years. They have children. But it's been a rough marriage because he interrupted her ability to finish working the steps. And he knew better, too. He was a sponsor and all that. But he was just so enamored by this woman, he wasn't going to – there was nothing that was going to stop him until the blush was off the rose. And then we had to do a lot of work on that.
What I think is that there's when people tend to idealize someone else, they don't know them that well, but they idealize them, that often that's because they feel so bad about themselves. The unconscious belief is that if someone that great loves me, then I guess I'm pretty good. So to the extent that we either devalue someone or we envy them or we idealize them, it's really a reflection of how much shame we have about ourselves, how much we devalue ourselves. And then, of course, a lot of times couples do that to an extreme when they're codependent. And then, as you say, after the blush wears off, after 6 months or a year, whatever it takes, and they start to get to know the person and see the reality, then what happens is they often try to remake them into who they idealized them in the first place. It wasn't even real. They try to change the person, and that never works.
Yeah, there was a song lyric I did back in the 60s and 70s. Neil Young had said something to the effect. She said, "Don't ever
change,
but I let her." Yeah, but I let her. "Don't ever change, but I let her." She changed me.
Yeah, there was a song by, says, "Don't try to change me," by, I can't think of his name, one of my favorite songwriters.
So, Harold, do you have any comments?
Well, this has been a great program, and I really want to get a copy of the book and study the things. I think that we're really onto some important concepts for recovery, and it reminds me of Stephen Stosny. Have you heard of Dr. Stosny?
No.
He writes about cycles between couples with shame and fear.
I should look into that. Mm-hmm.
When he gives an example where the couple is in the car, he's driving, she notices something on the road ahead and startles, and that he becomes angry, which startles her even more, and so they're into a vicious cycle of shame and fear. And it really, I've shared that with couples, and they can really identify with that.
Well, I wanted to name the book, actually, Shame, Love, Silent Destroyer, because I think it does that, and I spend a whole chapter, the largest one in the book, on relationships, and I talk about how, because of the underlying internalized shame that we use, and then we feel responsible for others, as I said, and we can't take any responsibility for ourselves because of the shame, so we blame, we deny, and then we use defenses to shame, such as blame, projection, denial, withdrawal, attacking, rage. All those things are ways to defend from feeling this horrible shame about ourselves. And then it just bounces back and forth. So you might have an argument start over nothing, and let's say a wife says, why don't you pick up your clothes or something like that? Or the husband says, "Where did you put my socks?" And she says, "I didn't. Why don't you take care of your, I didn't do anything to them. It's not my job." Pretty soon they're in an argument. One's blaming the other. The other spouse defends or attacks or withdraws. And withdrawal is experienced as abandonment and shaming. And so the other partner is going to either withdraw, so they both withdraw and they're not speaking, or attack, or keep badgering and blaming, and that will make one, the first one withdraw more, or attack, and these cycles keep escalating, and they don't get to the bottom of it. And, of course, it's hard for them to be vulnerable and open and honest because of their shame, so they can never really build bridges of, you know, back to each other, of empathy. So you're exactly right, you know, Harold.
Dr. Sosny runs boot camps for compassion. He says the key to this whole thing is compassion.
Right. The last step of my 8 steps of recovery is self-love and compassion, because that's where it starts. I'd like to be able to share with your listeners a free PDF that I'm offering. It's on my website. It's called 14 Tips for Letting Go. And
wonderful.
If they go to whatiscodependency.com, it's all one word, and they just fill in their email address, they can get that 14 tips. I also have some talks that are on YouTube and on my website under events. I'm on Facebook. If people want to, I post daily tips and links and insights and things like that. If people want to follow me, it's just, you can go look for my name, Darlene Lancer, that's L-A-N-C-E-R, or facebook.com/codependencyrecovery. So, and
that's,
I blog
terrific.
Every month too. So
that's my, great.
Yeah, my blog last month was on denial. Before that it was people-pleasing. Before that it was obsessions and love addiction. So every month I write a blog. You can sign up through your browser to subscribe to my blog. It's another way to
through Facebook? Through Facebook or
well,
your
I
website?
Well, I do post it on Facebook, but you can do it right on my blog page, which is part of my website. If you click on the bookmark tab of your browser, I think there's a little heading there to subscribe to this page or to this blog, and then you will get an RSS feed every month when my blog comes out.
Okay.
That's terrific. So it's whatiscodependency.com?
Yeah, and I have all my books there, Codependency for Dummies, the new one, Conquering Shame and Codependency, and I have 3 e-books. One is 10 Steps to Self-Esteem, The Ultimate Guide to Stop Self-Criticism, because I think working with our inner critic is the number one way to start to heal our self-esteem and our shame. And
yes.
Then because learning to be assertive is so important in communicating, in relationships, in your work, in building your self-esteem, I wrote a little e-book called How to Speak Your Mind, Become Assertive and Set Limits, which includes how to set boundaries. And they're both on Amazon and smashwords.com. And I just put out a new one called Daily Codependency Recovery Daily. I can't think of the name of it at the moment. It's so funny. Anyway, it's a daily reader of basically it's the highlights of several years of Facebook posts. So there's images and links and pictures and thoughts for the day and tips and articles and things like that. It's a daily reader of like a one day at a time on codependency recovery.
That's great. What a great idea.
Yeah, and they're all very inexpensive. They're just $3.99 to make them.
Now, I have a couple of clients whose self-esteem is way too high already. Do you have some ideas on how to bring them down a couple notches?
Well, yeah, because underneath that is shame. It's their, I call it impaired self-esteem, because
yes.
Narcissists have, think highly of themselves, but underneath there's tremendous shame. So, you know, exploring You know, how would they feel if they didn't? Usually, like, there's clues and there's a lot of things to look for that you could see that I point out in my book, because most of the shame is unconscious. So it might be projected onto someone else, or they feel better than another race or another class or things like that. So they boost them. It's like being a bully. So
yeah.
I'm better than you, so I don't have to feel less than you. So finding, like I had a client that said to me, thought he had very good self-esteem, didn't relate to any of that. But then he said to me, well, why do you think I'm so defensive? Because I get into arguments with my wife, and she says I'm, like, very defensive. I'm very, like, sensitive to criticism. So that was, like, a door that we could explore. Well, maybe it's because you criticize yourself. And so
yeah.
Even though he had high self-esteem, he started to admit that he judges himself in a way because he's not doing enough. He has high self-esteem, but he has unrealistic, perfectionistic standards. So he's never doing enough.
Yes.
So then, of course, he's always failing and feels bad about himself that he's not even good enough. And I talk about in Chapter 2 of my book how one of the ways children get by in a dysfunctional family is to set up these ideals. I mentioned that earlier. So that I'm going to be very good, or I'm going to be very strong, or very smart, or very powerful. And they set up these unrealistic ideals, and that's how they're going to get love and feel safe and, you know, feel important and valuable. So that might be a road to get in with this person.
Interesting. I like to think of when you fall in love with yourself, it's the beginning of a lifelong romance.
Sounds like a good quote.
it is. I've had to come to the agreement, and this has helped me. I mean, it has a negative twist to it in a way, but it really kind of fits for me. It's some people don't know me and they don't like me. Some people get to know me, then they don't like me. It's none of my business what you think of me, because you think so little of me anyway. If not in stature, surely in time. Most people are too busy thinking about themselves. The only time somebody's thinking about me usually is that I gave them a resentment. So that means I got free rent in their head, and if I'm in there long enough, I can build a room addition. The alcoholic's like that. I had one guy, 44 years of sobriety. He got angry. If I told you the story, you wouldn't believe it, but he was angry for me for a year and a half. And finally he called me over in the meetings. We have to put this away. And I go, well, I'm okay. He says, you know what I'm talking about. I had free rent in this guy's head for a year and a half, and he had 44 years of sobriety. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So after that, I never really could latch on to the length of time someone had. I think it's nice to see. But if the person's not living life on life's terms, if he's not living life like a loose garment, if he's not still extending his hand to the next sufferer, he kind of missed the program.
Mm-hmm. Right.
He had a lot of years, but he missed a lot of days.
It's true. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Darlene. This is very informative. Thank you, Harold,
thank you.
For coming on. You're welcome. It's always
welcome.
A pleasure. I mean, you know, you have such, and you weren't there. I don't think you heard that we had a comment when I was marketing out the show. One fella just couldn't stop, just praised Darlene, said really saved his life with the information that he got from one of her books.
That's so nice
really,
to hear.
And he went on and on. And then he took the, because I send them out, I sent you a link. I try to be cute with the link things to make it interesting. And he took that and he posted it out.
Oh, so
he
great.
Was so excited. Yeah, so he was excited about getting the word out.
Oh, thank you.
And that's what, you're welcome. So thanks, guys, for being there. And like usual, what we'll say is we're in 151 foreign countries, including Mississippi. We're in 2,800 towns, cities, and villages. And we've had about between 200,000 and 300,000 hits to the website in the 5 years that we put it together. So, and matter of fact, it's all over the world. We're very popular in Nepal. You know why we're popular in Nepal?
You're the only station.
They like our yak.
Oh, very cute. Well,
yeah.
I just remembered the name of my newest ebook. I'll just share it with you. It's called Codependency Recovery Daily Reflections.
Oh, that's great.
Codependency Recovery Daily Reflections.
Daily Reflections, yeah.
There's something there
every
day to think about to, you know, add to your recovery, yeah. So.
I wrote this recently, and I've been throwing it out every so often, you know, because we go one day at a time. And there was a titan by the name of Sisyphus. Are you familiar with the story, Darlene?
Oh, yes. That's how I felt when I was in a relationship with a practicing alcoholic. You can't control something that you can't control another person.
So Sisyphus was one of the titans, and when the Olympian gods took over creation, they got rid of all the titans and they cast them down, right? And it was the Gorgon and the Medusa. And Sisyphus was one, very strong. He was known for strength. And he was cursed that he had to roll a boulder every day up to the top of a steep mountain. And at night, when he slept, the boulder would roll back down, and then he would have that task again for all eternity. And when the gods came to ridicule and laugh at him, he would be there. He would smile in contentment. Do you know why he would do that? Because he knew exactly what he was going to do the next day. And after all, isn't it one mountain, one boulder, and one day at a time?
Yeah, exactly.
So thanks again. So in closing, we'd like to tell you, if you're looking for sponsorship information and some good other than sponsorship, but we have really good sponsorship information on the website. And remember, we'll see you on the radio, rumradio.org. Good night.
Good night.
Good night.